From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Forbidden Knowledge. Here's what's happening. Uber Technologies is not criminally liable in a March 2018 crash in Tempe, Arizona, in which one of the company's self-driving cars struck and killed a pedestrian as she was walking across the street when this self-driving vehicle smashed into her. The county attorney out there said in the letter made public that there was no basis for criminal liability for Uber, but that the conduct of the backup driver, Rafael Vasquez, should be referred to Tempe police for additional investigation. Police said last year that Vasquez was streaming a television show on a phone until about the time of the crash and called the incident entirely avoidable. He was apparently sitting in the car and should have been paying attention. A man who kept a 9-year-old lion in his backyard was found mauled to death in eastern Czech Republic. Michael Prosek's father found his mangled body in the lion's cage, which had been locked from the inside. Jeez. A man in Australia has admitted in court that he choked an Airbnb guest to death over an unpaid bill, but claims he's guilty of manslaughter instead of murder. He's 42 years old. He's on trial for killing a 36-year-old person who owed him $149. Jeez. The National Security Agency is considering ending a once secret surveillance program that annually collects hundreds of millions of telephone call records, including those belonging to Americans, because it lacks operational value, they say. Terminating the program, which was exposed publicly by former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden nearly 6 years ago, would represent a stunning admission by the agency. A group of North Korean hackers believed to be actively targeting U.S. businesses and critical infrastructure, according to a report released this week by a cybersecurity firm. Let's check in with OnlineColumnist.com's Dr. John Curtis. Geez, in the middle of that meeting, they were still doing this hacking between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, John, but the hacking continued.
Well, I mean, when you look at North Korea, it's really a mafia-like organization.
Yeah.
And they are living under some pretty restrictive financial sanctions, which, of course, was the reason why Trump apparently walked, although North Korea has a different interpretation, saying that, oh, well, Kim only wanted to have alleviation of sanctions that were authorized by the UN Security Council. But, you know, the bottom line is that North Korea is broke. They're starving there. And the way the criminal enterprise works is they hack into banking systems, not just in the U.S.
All over the world. All over the place.
Around the world they do it. But primarily, George, in the richest countries they can find, like Germany, like the U.K., so the banking center in London or in Frankfurt. And they will hack into banks and literally transfer billions of dollars of cash out of empty, you know, the coffers out in financial institutions because they're in such a desperate shape. So this is the regime that Trump is dealing with, where, I mean, you have to give him credit for going the extra mile over there. It wasn't just a publicity stunt. If he wanted to, you know, create some kind of a dog and pony show and, you know, have a fraudulent signing ceremony, he could have done it. But he realized that, you know, no deal is better than a worthless deal. And, you know, they always cite the Iran nuke deal back in 2015 of handing the Iranians billions and billions of dollars in order to get some kind of deal from them. So I think what you're dealing with, and John McAfee, who's a real cybersecurity expert, is on top of this, and he's advising, I believe he's advising Germany right now as to, you know, with Deutsche Bank, what, you know, they can do in order to protect themselves against these very sophisticated thieves that are out there stealing primarily money out of banks.
They're doing well. I wonder if the president gave Kim a signed copy of his book, The Art of the Deal.
I'm not sure about that, but I know that part of the art of the deal is walking away from a deal and coming back to it later. But I think Trump is still practicing that. Although if you ask Tony Schwartz, he'd tell you that Trump didn't write one word of that book. And, you know, none of the ideas were even Trump.
Oh, and Tony regrets writing the book now, too.
He does.
All right, thanks, John.
100%.
John's website, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, the store Kohl's, K-O-H-L, thinks it can draw customers by shrinking stores and leasing out space to gyms and supermarkets. On Tuesday, they said they would lease out space to Planet Fitness next to 10 of its stores in 2019. And if the experiment takes off, Kohl's would expand the partnership to more locations. But they're getting smacked around by Amazon, as so many other bricks-and-mortar retail stores are. An asteroid as big as a jumbo jet made a close flyby of Earth yesterday. We're okay. It missed us by some 274,000 miles. But maybe it's just a matter of when we'll get hit. Let's check in with space expert Mike Barra. Mike, what do you think about asteroids anyways? Do you think it's just a matter of time?
Well, yeah, it is a matter of time. And, I mean, it does scares the heck out of me, George, because, I mean, you know, we know as fairly recently as possibly the Tunguska event in 1908, which probably was a bolide that exploded in midair, that they can do incredible damage, even if they're very small like this one, depending on what they're made of and the energy and the compression and everything that takes place if they detonate. Now, if this thing was as big as, say, the comet or asteroid that caused the Younger Dryas impact event back about 12,000 years ago, I mean, it could basically change the entire climate of the Earth to put us back into an ice age for 1,200, 1,300 years. So even if it isn't an extinction level event, even if it isn't one of these horrible, massive worldwide extinctions that we would see, I mean, even smaller asteroids, which are very, very hard to spot and track, could cause absolute devastation, especially if they struck a U.S. city or a city anywhere in the world. I mean, if that Tunguska event had taken place over Moscow, Moscow would have been completely wiped off the map. So it's pretty frightening. And the thing is that we don't seem to be doing all that much to try to not just track these things, but to figure out ways to shoot them down, blow them up, deflect their trajectory. We're just not really doing very much at all. It's kind of like the power grid. We're not doing anything to protect the U.S. power grid, and I just don't get it.
And one day something's going to happen, Mike, and you'll be on this program saying, see, I told you so, folks.
Yeah, I hope not.
That's sad. Mike, thank you. Mike's the website, MikeBarra, BARA.com. Your heart can be damaged after a sad event, and it may be your brain's doing, according to experts. Swiss researchers have been studying people with a rare and unusual condition called broken heart syndrome. It's unbelievable. They say the weakening and failing of the heart happens suddenly, often after a stressful or emotional event such as bereavement. Story at coasttocoastam.com. Loch Ness Monster has been spotted twice in the last 5 days. It's an amazing story. Go read it at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, fluoride in our water. Paul Conant joins us, and we'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Paul Conant is a graduate of Cambridge University, holds a Ph.D. in chemistry from Dartmouth College. From 83 to 2006, Paul taught chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, where he specialized in environmental chemistry and toxicology. Over the past 33 years, his research on waste management has taken him to 49 states, 7 provinces in Canada, 65 other countries, and he has given more than 2,500 public presentations. Paul, welcome back to the program. You were on our show 8 years ago almost.
Yes, George. Thanks for having me back.
My pleasure. Good to have you with us, too. Hey, let me ask you this. You have been involved in chemistry and water fluoridation investigation for a long time. Why did they put fluoride in the water in the first place?
Ostensibly to lower tooth decay. That's what they believed. The evidence is very weak that actually swallowing fluoride lowers tooth decay. In fact, the promoters now concede that the major benefit is topical. It works on the surface of the tooth. You don't have to swallow it. And quite frankly, when they admitted that, that should have been the end of water fluoridation if you don't need to swallow it.
Exactly, because by swallowing it, does what to us?
Well, it's very toxic, and we know it's very toxic. It can kill people, but we know it's toxic because nature has developed defense mechanisms back in about 2012, I think Ron Breaker at Yale University showed that in certain lower creatures like bacteria and fungi, there were genes which, when they were switched on by high fluoride levels, they would produce proteins which went to the membranes and pumped the fluoride out of the body. They were called fluoride-exporting proteins. And the only reason that nature developed those was because fluoride is very toxic to the system. Now, when the time you get to the mammals, like ourselves, we have the kidney. The kidney gets rid of about 50% of the fluoride that we take in. And a lot of the rest is sequestered in our bones. It's a defense mechanism. Now, the other defense mechanism, which I've always thought was very, very important, was mother's milk. The mother's breast acts like a filter. Very, very little fluoride is in mother's milk. And so the newborn baby, it gets very, very little fluoride. And obviously, if it was a nutrient or we needed it for something, that's where you'd expect to find it. But it's not there. But that also means in a city like Los Angeles, which is fluoridated, a bottle-fed baby is getting about 200 times more fluoride than nature intended.
Well, plus we're getting it in our toothpaste. Almost every toothpaste has fluoride in it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Over 90% of the toothpaste sold in the United States has fluoride in it. You also have fluoride in pesticides and fertilizer, obviously all the dental products. In fact, you can't get the ADA's seal of approval for a dental product unless it's got fluoride in it. So the ADA is making a lot of money out of people's willingness to swallow fluoride.
I remember in my grade school days, Paul, the school district sold our parents on fluoridation. And what would happen is a dentist would come to the school and we'd all be signed up to get fluoride treatments. It was like a 2 or 3 day treatment program. And we'd sit there in this chair while this dentist blasted away at this fluoride in our mouth. I kept coming home telling my mom, I don't want to do this anymore. And she said, no, Georgie, it's good for you. And, you know, they had our parents buffaloed. But we went through that. Will that eventually show any harm to us?
Well, absolutely. And they can't even deny it, because the one thing that they knew in 1945, when this nonsense began, was that a certain percentage of children would get a condition called dental fluorosis, which is a mottling of the teeth, the patches, white patches, which in some conditions can get yellow, brown, and so on. They knew about 10% of the kids would get this condition, but only in its very mild form. And the trade-off was lower tooth decay. So you lower the tooth decay, and you get some kids would get this condition, but only dentists would recognize it. And that was the mantra in 1945. Now run the clock forward to the current time, and over 60% of American teens, kids aged 12 to 15, now have some form of dental fluorosis. And not all in the stuff you wouldn't notice. Some mild dental fluorosis impacts about 20%. Moderate dental fluorosis, which impacts 100% of the tooth surface, 24%. So this is out of control. It's an epidemic now. And it's exactly what you said, George. We're getting fluoride from everywhere today.
Yep.
And everywhere.
Correct me, Paul, if I'm wrong, but did I not see, like, vans and trucks that had fluoride in them? They were carting it, and it had a skull and bones on it. It's poison, isn't it?
This is the most bizarre aspect to this story. You would think, wouldn't you, that the fluoride that you added to the drinking water was a pharmaceutical grade, the same kind of grade that you put in food product, dental products.
Or vitamins or something like that.
No, it's taken from the scrubbing systems of the phosphate fertilizer industry. Literally, it's a spray of water which converts two very toxic gases, hydrogen fluoride, silicon tetrafluoride, which are produced when phosphate rock is treated with sulfuric acid. And these gases decimated the local areas in Florida, Polk County, Florida, for years, until they finally said, we better scrub this stuff out. So they put a water spray on, and that converts it to a substance called hexafluorosilicic acid. And that's the stuff, that hexafluorosilicic acid, which is contaminated with God knows what, is then sent untreated to the public waterworks.
All over the country.
All over the country. And the way they get around this, they say the EPA has a regulation which says hazardous waste must be treated this way unless another company buys the waste from the chemical industry. So the chemical industry produces a chemical waste and somebody buys it from him. It then becomes a product. And it's under those weird conditions that the public water works now, because they buy it from the chemical industry. It's treated as a product, and we can't dump it into the sea. I mean, can you believe this?
So we dump it into our drinking water.
We can't dump it into the sea, but we flush it through our bodies en route to the sea. It is incredible. It's bizarre.
And they sell it to the companies that manufacture toothpaste and stuff like that, I guess.
No, I think that the stuff that goes to the tooth manufacturers, the toothpaste people, is pharmaceutical grade. So that would be purified.
Which is still not great, but it's better than dumping the stuff in the water, right?
Absolutely. And the reason, of course, if you use pharmaceutical grade, they would say it's too expensive, because 99% of the water doesn't go anywhere near your teeth. It goes, it washes the car, waters the lawn, does the washing up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Less than 1% we actually swallow. And so very little goes near our teeth. So you can afford to use this chemical, because if the truth be known, the phosphate fertilizer industry would give it to you to get rid of it, because otherwise they have to treat it as a hazardous waste. But as it is, they're making between $100 and $200 million a year out of this.
Out of junk.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Now, who scammed the American Dental Association and all these dentists who are pro-fluoridation?
Well, I think the trouble is, I think they're true believers there. I think if you go back to the 1940s, they really believed this would work. They felt, believed that it was completely safe. They didn't do the science. Now, this is another extraordinary thing. You know, they started the trials in 45 in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and in a place, I've forgotten the name now, in New York State. But they started these trials. They were meant to be 10-year trials, but halfway through them, in 1950, the U.S. Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation for the whole country. Said, go ahead. Well, that wasn't scientific. They hadn't completed the trials. They had practically no health studies on the books. And after the U.S. Public Health Service endorsed it, they didn't bother to do any more studies. As far as they were concerned, the whole issue now was promotion. And that's what we've had ever since 1950, is the promotion of fluoridation as safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective, with very little attempt to look at the science. The good news is we are just beginning to look at some of the science of fluoride's impact on tissues like the brain, the thyroid gland, and so on. Things which they should have done 70 years ago, they're just beginning to do today. And the results are shocking, George, absolutely shocking.
And that was Newburg, New York, the other city.
Yes, that's right.
Where they were doing this. Jeez, this is frustrating. It really is. And yet so many dentists today think fluoride is so good.
Yeah, unfortunately, not many dentists have the time with their busy practices to actually read the literature. At dental school, they only get one thing at dental school. It's perfectly safe, and the people opposed to fluoridation are a bunch of Looney Tunes.
That's right.
That's what they're told at dental school. Then they leave, they start their busy practices, and they just don't bother to do the research, or not many, and they just take the word of the ADA and the CDC at face value, not realizing that these guys are absolutely, utterly biased. And it's very worrying to me that the government agency should be so biased on something as important as what our kids are getting in their drinking water.
How did you get on this platform, Paul?
My wife, in 1996, she came to me one afternoon with a cup of tea. She put the cup of tea on my desk and she says, Paul, would you read this? And I said, what is it? She said, fluoridation. I said, take it away. Those people are crazy. So I had fallen, George. I had fallen for this Dr. Strangelove, this contrived attitude that the people opposed to fluoridation were somehow loony, crazy people. And as a professor at university, I didn't want to be labeled as Looney Tunes. So I resisted her. Three other people had asked me previously to look into this. Somebody in Ohio, somebody in Ontario.
Hold on for a second, Paul. We're at the break. We'll come back. We'll pick that up right there. Plus, we'll take calls next hour with Paul Conant as we talk about fluoridation. And welcome back. We're back with Dr. Paul Conant. Paul, we were talking about how you got involved in this, and you said your wife was the one who brought it to your attention.
Yes. As I said, the three other people had tried to get me involved, but I was too busy, and I didn't want to be labeled as crazy. But my wife was very persuasive, so I did read what she put on my table that afternoon, and I was absolutely shocked. In 1996, that was, and that coincided with the publication of the first two IQ studies from China, studies which showed that kids exposed to higher levels of fluoride had lowered IQ. Now, run the clock forward, we've had 60 IQ studies, of which 53 show that kids with the higher fluoride exposure have lowered IQ. And now I want to tell you, Joe, about the most important paper. And if people listening only read one scientific paper on this issue, this is the one to read. It was published on September the 19th, 2017. It was a bombshell. It was a bombshell because, A, it was funded. It was funded by the U.S. government. So the people that promote fluoride finally got around to doing a decent study. It was a 12-year study done by leading experts in the field, and it was based upon 300 mother-offspring pairs. And what they did is they measured the levels of fluoride in the urine of pregnant women. So they had a measure of that gives you a measure of total exposure to fluoride of those women, independent. That's independent of the source. You measure the fluoride in the urine, that's your total exposure. Doesn't matter if it comes from salt, water, whatever. Then when the children were born, they measured their IQ. They measured the IQ at 4 and again between 6 and 12. And what they found was a very strong association. The higher the fluoride levels in the mother's urine, the lower the IQ.
Gee.
And for an increase in the urine of 1 milligram per liter, there was a drop of 5 to 6 IQ points. Now, that 1 milligram per liter is approximately the difference between living in a fluoridated community and a non-fluoridated community. And in fact, in 2018, there was a study done in Canada which looked at the levels of fluoride in the urine of pregnant women there throughout Canada, large study, and they found almost identical. The levels of fluoride in the urine of Canadian women in fluoridated communities was 0.87 parts per million. The level in Mexico City, where the Bashar study was done, was 0.91, so almost identical. So at the levels at which we are fluoridating, there's a very good study, excellent study. They control for every variable you can think of, which shows a relationship between the amount of fluoride that a pregnant woman is exposed to during pregnancy and the intelligence of their children. And that's really a bombshell.
It's huge. Now, are there other symptoms where people can literally get sick from too much fluoride?
Oh, yeah, you can get sick from too much fluoride. And there are people that are very sensitive to fluoride, have a whole litany of reversible symptoms like tiredness not relieved by sleep, pains in the joints, rashes, and all these kinds of things. So there are some people out there that are very sensitive. There are canaries, if you like. They're the ones who tell us what it would be like for us if we got higher levels. But I think lowering the IQ of our children by 5 IQ points is devastating. Just to give you an idea, because people get, numbers. But if you drop the IQ of the population of the United States by 5 IQ points, you wouldn't notice much of a difference with the average child. But the result would be you'd halve the number of very bright children in society, the number of geniuses, if you like, the kids with an IQ above 130, that fraction would be halved. And the number of kids who are less than 70, which is the borderline mentally handicapped, would increase by about 50%. And that's a devastating thing to do to a country like the United States.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And yet this important study, it was published in Environmental Health Perspectives. It was done by people from the University of Toronto, McGill, Indiana, Michigan, Harvard, Mount Sinai. I mean, we're talking top-notch scientists did this study. And I can't help feeling that the reason it was funded by the NIH and the EPA is they wanted to show that we were wrong, that all our concerns about the IQ studies done in China and India was, you know, far-fetched. It wasn't real. So they would do a study. Well, they did the study, and they confirmed it. But it wasn't covered in the New York Times. It wasn't covered in the Washington Post. And we're not warning pregnant women. I mean, if people could do one thing after listening to this show, and that is that they know any woman that's pregnant, for God's sake, tell that woman to avoid fluoride during pregnancy. Don't use fluoridated toothpaste. Don't drink fluoridated water. And avoid any source of fluoride.
That's a good point. Now, you just came back from Bangladesh. What were you doing there?
Oh, my wife and I were involved. We've been activists all our lives. In fact, we met as activists in 1968 in New York City. And we were involved with the Biafran issue for 2 years in New York City. And then soon after that, we were involved in Bangladesh. And I was involved with their struggle. I went in with the freedom fighters with a camera to show what was going on inside Bangladesh. Took in medical supplies to give to the villagers and so on. Went in with 140 Mukti Bahini, as they were called. And when I was inside Bangladesh, I found, to my horror, heard over the Pakistan radio that my wife had been arrested. She had tried to deliver medicine and saris to a village just inside the border, but she was captured by the Pakistan army. So I had to quickly get out of Bangladesh. It wasn't quick. It took us 7 days and seven nights to get out of what was then East Pakistan. And when I got out, crossing the border, there were two people in the fields there, and they said, oh, Operation Omega, that was the name of the group, your workers have been sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Gee.
Oh, my God. So now I had to get back to America and try to calm down her parents. This is the first time I've seen them after we got married. We got married in New York City in 1970. The next day we left for Europe. So the next time they saw their son-in-law, he was telling them that their daughter had been arrested for the crime of trying to get help to the people in Bangladesh. Anyway, it was a very, very dramatic, exciting time for us. Everything worked out well. My wife found she was pregnant when she was in Jessore prison, and as a result, we named our first child Peter William Mujib after Sheikh Mujib, who was the hero, the leader of the Bengalis in this whole movement. But the Bangladesh, that they've had us now back for the second time because they really are so obsessed with this liberation movement. In 1971, they set up a huge liberation museum. And we provided them with lots of our memorabilia, photographs, articles, and so on. They're very happy with that. And guess what? This isn't fluoride, is it? But anyway, one of the things which is very dramatic, they took us to the Liberation War Museum. They showed us all the stuff that we've put in there. And as a surprise, they produced the captain that led the Mukti Bahini that I went in with, 140 armed to the teeth they were. The captain who led that, I hadn't seen for 48 years, and they produced him. He was 83, walking with a stick, but it was the most amazing and emotional moment to meet up with this fellow that had protected
me. Did he remember you?
Yes, of course. There were only two of us, both English. At the time I was English, now American. So that's what we were doing in Bangladesh. And now we're concerned about the Rohingya, you know, these people that have been persecuted in Myanmar. And Bangladesh is very generously looking after about 1 million of these refugees.
Do they have fluoride in their water out there, Paul?
Oh, no. there are areas in the subcontinent where you've got high natural levels of fluoride, but very few countries deliberately add fluoride to the drinking water. Only about 20, and of those, only 10 have more than 50% of their water fluoridated.
Is there any research that compares fluoridated countries with non-fluoridated countries in terms of tooth decay or anything like that?
Yes. Yes, the World Health Organization keeps track of tooth decay in 12-year-olds in many different countries. And from their data, you can see that tooth decay has been coming down in 12-year-olds from the 60s to the present as rapidly in non-fluoridated countries as fluoridated ones. And the difference today is you couldn't tell the difference. So that is not the best science because it's very, very broad statistics on a national level. But, you know, if there was a strong relationship, you'd expect it to rise above the noise, but it doesn't. And, you know, they've never done a randomized control trial, the RCT as they're called, to demonstrate that swallowing fluoride actually lowers tooth decay. So that's pretty dubious, isn't it? After 75 years, they haven't done an RCT. And one of the reasons for that is the Food and Drug Administration has never got involved with this issue. So according to the FDA, fluoride is an unapproved drug. So we're putting an unapproved drug into the drinking water. It's a hazardous waste. And George, if
horrible.
Look into this, your hair would fall out. It really would. I've written a book on this with two other professors, a retired professor of physics, retired professor of biology and a retired professor of chemistry, that's me, The Case Against Fluoride. I think people will get a very good idea of this nonsense if they read that book. Meanwhile, go to our webpage, fluoridealert.org, and amongst other things, you will see that BASHASH study that I talked about, this very important U.S. government-funded study, which shows this relationship between fluoride exposure to pregnant women and lowered IQ.
That's an amazing story. Does fluoride affect other parts of the body other than,
It's a very toxic substance. It interferes with all kinds of biological systems. I mean, we've known that for years. It interferes with enzymes. Nobel laureates in enzyme chemistry oppose fluoridation in the United States. People like James Sumner from Cornell. Interferes with enzymes, it interferes with G proteins, it causes oxidative stress, it switches on a plethora of genes. So there's a very good review article by Barbier, I think in 2012, for those who are into biochemistry. So the mechanisms are there. It is absolutely the least scientific public health practice of all time. The oral health division of the CDC says this is one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. Can you believe that?
Jeez.
It's one of the top 10 public frauds of the 20th
century. That's amazing. What happens to your pets, like your dog or your cat, that might drink tap water?
Yeah, well, one of the things we're concerned about is that 50% of the fluoride goes into your bones. And larger dogs, their bones... You'll know that larger dogs, their back legs go after 5 or 6 years, and this is possibly the accumulation of fluoride.
They get that hip dysplasia and stuff
in their bones.
That's not good.
No, not good. And for us humans, the first symptoms of skeletal fluorosis, which is well known around the world where you've got areas with high natural fluoride levels, the first symptoms are like arthritis.
Well, how do we know? We see a lot of older people, Paul, who are with the walkers and canes.
Yeah.
How do we know that the fluoride hasn't made that happen to them?
We don't know, George, because they have not done the studies. As I said earlier on, for 70 years, no important basic studies on other tissues in the body, other than teeth. They studied teeth, as if our bodies were teeth with a couple of legs on it. They study the teeth to death. But they don't study the thyroid gland, they don't study the brain, the bones, and the other endocrine system, the liver and kidney. For those kind of studies, we've had to go to India and China, where they've had high natural levels, And the irony is that our people say, oh, you can't trust anything from India and China. And they dismiss all these studies, and which is crazy, because they don't have a practice to protect. In the United States, we protect fluoridation, so we don't do the studies. That's been the case until relatively recently. But in India and China, they genuinely want to know what level causes harm to which tissues, so they know to what level they have to remove fluoride down to protect their citizens. So they've been doing some very, very good studies. But now in the United States and Canada, we're seeing those studies reproduced. But unfortunately, the major mainstream media are ignoring this science. It's not being published in out-of-the-way magazines. This is being published in Environmental Health Perspectives, one of the leading environmental health journals in the world.
Are there any benefits to fluoride at all? I mean, does it prevent tooth decay?
Well, there are two schools of thought here. One school of thought says it works topically, that it works on the surface of the teeth. And that there have been, I mentioned there was no RCTs, so randomized clinical trials, for demonstrating that swallowing fluoride lowers tooth decay. However, there have been 70 randomized controlled trials demonstrating that fluoridated toothpaste lowers tooth decay. So there is more evidence that it works topically. So brush it on your teeth, but and spit it out. This way you can minimize exposure to all the other tissues in the body, including the brain, and you're not forcing it on people that don't want it. So immediately, the moment in 1999 when the Center for Disease Control conceded that the predominant benefit of fluoride was topical, that was the moment that they should have abandoned fluoridating the water and instead using a different delivery system for those who believed in fluoride, namely fluoridated toothpaste.
This is frightening, Paul. Who's going to get this done? Who's going to be the champion to get this fixed?
I tell you, I've been doing this for 23 years. It's the most frustrating thing I've ever tried in my life. It's made me so depressed because as a scientist, I'm a scientist and an activist. So clearly I've got some question marks. I mean, I can understand why people would be suspicious of anything I say scientifically because I am an activist. It's not enough for me to say something is bad. I want to stop something that's bad. So I spend all my life essentially trying to stop this. But I do keep my science straight. I do not massage the science. If it's there, I talk about it and I explain it the best I can and I document everything we have to say. Our book has 80 pages of documentation. But it's so frustrating for me as a scientist to just have science torn up in my face by doctors, dentists, health officials, people from the EPA.
Yeah. When you know.
Not being scientific.
We're going to come back and take calls with you, Paul, as we continue chatting about this incredible story. So share your stories with us if you can.